And that's not a euphemism.
That is not. Yeah. Hang on. Moving my. Let's turn that off. And
you couldn't settle your desk before we got started.
I had a muffin. And which I'll explain in a second. That's Andy Williams.
It is.
Moon River. And I did that not because it has anything to do with anything.
We're not talking about Breakfast at Tiffany's.
We're not talking about Breakfast at Tiffany's. We're not talking about any movies that involve the moon.
It is raining, however.
It's raining. Well, that's not even relevant either.
Okay.
Just that you are really fond of shaming me when I play noisy, loud intro music. And I just wanted everyone to understand that I am not an animal.
You have a softer side.
I'm a human being.
Okay.
And I like Moon River, and I like Andy Williams. And I like these cinnamon muffins that have been graciously provided to us this morning by our guest. We have a third guest person.
And
today.
Before we introduce him, we should probably introduce ourselves because we tend to forget to do
Dave
that.
I am Dave White of Movies.com and also of, I don't know what
KCRW is unfictional.
That's right. KCRW of Los Angeles, National Public Radio Station in Los Angeles. The show is called Unfictional, okay. And I am on it sometimes.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm Alonzo Duraldi, film critic for The Wrap and What the Flick.
And our guest this morning, we were going to call you Manny Leitzano.
Yeah. Well,
that was what we were discussing before you showed
up. It's part of my whole nature. And, as a Mexican, I can never show up on time for anything.
But then, instead of busting your balls about it, you showed up with these really nice cinnamon muffins.
Hand me one of those. I
that are
have
on
one
a
yet.
Plate. Don't get it on your laptop, because that's what I just did to mine.
Oh, nice.
You know what I don't do to my laptop, though? Drop it on
the
floor.
Oh, fine.
Yeah.
That's not good.
Yeah. A laptop can absorb a few cinnamon sugary crumbs.
You think. You may find out later that won't
be
the case.
No. But it can't absorb being clonked on the floor because of inattention.
Yeah. This we have learned the hard way. Anyway
his name is actually Manny Lozano, and he is a senior editor at veryaware.com, veryaware.com. And
these muffins really are good.
We see Manny at screenings all the time. And we chat with Manny at screenings all the time. And then we were chatting about you coming on the show, and now you are here.
Yes, and I'm very excited.
Tell everyone.
Closer
what
to the mic, Manny.
Yeah, you gotta.
There you go. Is that better?
Get
yeah.
close.
Okay.
Get close to that microphone.
This is, you are, I'm podcast virgin. I've never actually been on a podcast.
You never been on a podcast before? They're dumb. And so,
well, if yours is dumb, yours is my favorite of all the dumb podcasts.
They're dumb the way we do it, anyway.
Fair enough.
Tell people what you do as a senior editor at veryaware.com.
So, I've been writing for VeryAware for about a little more than a year. It's myself, and sort of we have had a kind of rotating cast of writers. I do some theatrical reviews. The thing I do regularly is I do a DVD column every week of like what's coming out and all that, and I also do like home video, like Blu-ray reviews and stuff like that. So a little bit, kind of, since it's all sort of new, we all kind of try and just have our hands in everything and just kind of do. And, you know, I've covered the LA Film Festival and Comic-Con and all that kind of stuff before.
And you told me you want to talk about some movie today called Lego Witch.
Largo Winch. Which is close enough, but yeah,
you got to get in closer, man.
Yeah, okay.
We're drowning you.
There
out.
We go.
People think we make our guests sit in another room from the microphone.
Okay.
You know.
There we go.
Is it doing it?
Yeah, it's good now.
Okay. So I'll have to really sit into it. But yeah, so Largo Winch. It opened this weekend in select cities and on iTunes. It's a sort of Bourne meets Bond meets corporate espionage kind of a thriller.
Who's in it? Why have I never heard of this movie?
I got screening notices about it, but
yeah,
it sounded very French.
It's not super French.
Is
I was
it French?
It's
French
in English, French, and Croatian, oddly enough.
Is Kristen Scott Thomas?
She is.
That ding, was just a guess.
Ding, 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 ding.
That was just a guess.
Yes, she is. And she has, she is
I
doing...
I like how she's abandoned English film.
Yeah.
Like, there's just no...
Look,
like,
she goes where the work is.
She doesn't care. She's like, oh, I'm just going to be in movies in France all the time.
Yeah, and Kristen Scott Thomas is in her absolute best Bryony Tallis cosplay. She has the complete... hair, the Bryony Tallis haircut.
I don't
from
know.
From you're Atonement. Have to... It's,
Okay.
Yes, that haircut,
like,
that awful haircut.
The what? The huh?
Yeah, I didn't know if this was some anime character.
No, no, no. Well, she looks very close to that too.
Okay.
But so the whole idea is that there's this sort of big multinational, multi-billion-dollar faceless corporation run by this guy named Winch, who is murdered, and then you
is
find
his name Largo Winch.
No, his name is Nero Winch. He is the father of Largo Winch. And you find
These are
out
good names.
Yes. And you find out that Largo is the adopted son of Nero, and he is the heir apparent, which is the subtitle to the film. And he is the heir apparent to this huge corporation, and all of a sudden Largo has to prove who he is in order to kind of claim his place, and everyone wants him dead. So by, you know, 5 minutes in, people are getting, you know, shot through the eyeball in boardrooms, and, you know, there's car chases and motorcycle chases, and there's, you know, sexy time with ladies, like, 10 minutes in, and, you know, blowing up jails and all sorts of stuff like that. The thing that I sort of found with it, I liked it in a good sort of Sunday afternoon, turn your brain off, not really having, but not in a way where you feel...
Subtitles.
No, well, there's surprisingly not as many. So it's not, like, even though it is... partially in French, it's
that
not a lot
automatically
in French.
Automatically disqualifies it from being a Sunday afternoon turn your brain.
I guess. Well, part of the reason you're turning your brain off is because the dialogue is awful. Like, and it's a lot of, it's a lot of, like, especially because it alternates in this weird way between sort of the badass action of, you know, flipping cars over and blowing people up and all that great stuff, and then it goes into like these boardroom meetings where Kristen Scott Thomas is like the you know, the next in line for the corporation, and it just, and they're just kind of laying out plot, and they're just like laying out exposition, so it becomes really boring, and it's really sad. There's this one guy who plays a character named Mr. Huang, and he has the absolute worst dialogue out of ever.
Huang
with an H. And he just says...
Shut up, Beavis.
Yeah. And he says things like, why do you want me to give this loan to this guy we've just met? And all these, like, very obvious sort of things.
Exposition.
Right, and it becomes kind of mires the whole film down. But the rest of it is fun. It's a good... It's definitely, like, worth renting, I think. The lead, Tomer Sicily, is kind of... He is kind of like a... He comes off kind of like a young Vincent Cassel. Or Cassel, sorry, Vincent Cassel. And he's sort of, so he has a charisma and a charm to him that makes it less awful than it could be otherwise.
I've always thought Vincent Cassel was kind of a rat face. Is that just
he's
me?
He's not as creepy as he is more, he's like, he's a boy.
I mean, he's a good actor. I think I like his stuff, but he's kind of a rat face.
I when I see him on screen, I automatically know that I'm supposed to dislike him. It doesn't matter, you know, like what he is. In the movie, it's sort of like an automatic thing. Like, oh, Vincent Cassel's in this movie. He's going to be a bad guy.
Yeah.
Or just like a skeeve, or, you know, something like in The Dangerous Method. Like, that he's...
Right.
He's like the guy that just bangs all the chicks.
Yes.
And,
he's the id of the movie. We'll talk about that next week.
Yeah. But so, so it's on iTunes.
It's on iTunes.
So I could see it. I could watch it. I could stop this podcast.
Yes,
right now.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And I'm not stopping you. So.
I was not here last week. I was in Texas. And you were here, Alonzo, with, again, a very far away sounding James Rocky.
Look, I'm not...
I was like, what's James saying?
I'm not an expert at the audio. Like, I'm just looking at the level. I'm going to have to run this whole show through Levelator when we're done. Because we're going way up and way down. My apologies.
Am I too up and down?
It's okay. The third mic and everything, it's tricky.
Okay. Anyway, y'all forgot to talk about some very important things.
Which brings us to a section of the show we like to call Dave Chimes In.
Armie Hammer in J. Edgar.
Yeah.
Looks like someone from Trash Humpers.
Oh, God.
Okay, his old age makeup is
the worst.
Yeah, clearly
of all time.
Clearly,
there has never been old age makeup as bad as Armie Hammer. They devote all their energy to making Leo look like halfway decent.
Right.
As an old dude. And Armie Hammer seriously looks like he's wearing a trash humper's mask. That's what it is.
It is from the Play-Doh Fun Factory.
And that's the saddest thing about that is that I felt like Armie Hammer was the most important thing in the movie. Because he took all this speculative, information and made it...
An actual character
and real. And there was, in an otherwise sort of like... Brown film, that was the emotional stuff. Mm-hmm. I didn't dislike the movie. I like a good boring Clint Eastwood movie set many years ago. That's what I like.
Did you like Changeling?
Oh yes.
Oh really?
A lot.
Oh yeah, come totally on!
Changeling. I like the hat.
That movie was ridiculous.
I like everything Clint Eastwood does. I think except maybe for Hereafter, which is hilarious.
I was going to say.
But I
Space
even,
Cowboys,
I don't even
Blood
hate,
Work.
I don't even hate Hereafter because it's so funny. And so...
it's the most hilarious movie about a tsunami you'll ever see.
Yeah, it's gross. I now have a really awesome hookup in Dallas for screenings. So when I go there now to visit my mom, I don't have to see things on opening day.
Right.
I don't have to sneak into those public... One. Do you work for the media?
No.
I want it on a radio station.
Yeah. I got to see Immortals. Mm-hmm. And had either one of you seen Immortals last week?
No, neither. I still haven't seen it, actually.
I got to recommend that everybody go look at Immortals because it's idiotic.
But you're saying look at, I think it is the key phrase here.
Yeah. Because this guy. This Tarsem Singh guy is...
Oh, is he using a last name now?
Oh, he's using his full three-name. He's using his full three-name thing for this movie. Like, he's making important films now, so he's not just going by McGee.
Tarsem.
Yeah. This movie has the most awesome oil-slick tsunami, speaking of tsunamis, that has ever been in a film. Maybe it's the only one that's ever been in a film. But you never realized... how much you actually want this to happen to you. You know, an oil slick tsunami to come wash over you and coat your glistening muscles with black tar, crudely oil, and your hot chick Frida Pinto girlfriend, who is an oracle, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
This movie has so many things going on in it. It opens like it's a real movie with like a quote from Socrates. And then suddenly Mickey Rourke shows up and he's like, lustily devouring a pomegranate while wearing a metal Donnie Darko rabbit ears, and it's crazy from start to finish. Everything about it is insane and ridiculous, and it looks awesome. It looks awesome,
and our
it's
dear
crazy violent.
Our dear friend Shannon Lee Olds was the
our dear friend Shannon Lee Olds was a visual was
visual
a,
effects
or the
visual effects supervisor.
She got her own credit, not her own card, but when the credit
there was space above and below her name.
The credits roll in this movie. They are, you know how fast credits roll on TV now? Mm-hmm. It's like boom, 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 boom. Like you can't even read anything unless you slow your DVR down to slow motion.
Right.
That's how fast the credits roll in this movie. And there are two columns of names, because literally 700,000 people work on this movie. And she...
You start looking for your own name in movies like that, because you figure, well, this is just everybody on Earth, right?
You expect... Well, I sit through credits like that, because I want to find the people whose names are things like Bonky.
Yeah.
Or what was that weird name of a casting director or someone whose name was
I don't know. There's always...
Snookums?
Yeah, there's always some wacky names in there that I forget.
But that was her real... I'll have to go back and look at my notes, but Shannon had her own name on her own little line.
Nice.
Between giant blocks of columns.
She's
an important lady.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So she made it look... She made this terrible movie look awesome. Or at least she had a hand.
But that's kind of Tarsem's whole thing, is just... looking awesome
and
stuff like that.
His movies are rotten, but they're But they're so good looking all the time. In a really sort of dumb, you know, mass appeal kind
of
way.
See, now this is part of the problem of the studio system no longer existing, because back in the day, like, he would have been like the go-to art director, you know, or cinematographer or whatever. Right. But nobody would have said, oh, yes, let's let Cedric Gibbons make a movie, you know. Right. Let's let Adrian direct. Like, no, they did the thing they did, and they did it well, and then, you know, that was it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Is that all you're going to say?
That's it. That's all I got.
But you got to put up.
No.
Okay. Now, finally, one more thing.
Yes.
I have to tell you that I was wrong.
Ooh.
Wrong about something.
Really, Fonzie? What do you got? Which of the many things are you going to actually own up to?
Okay, I wasn't wrong. I'm just perhaps out of step, maybe, with the dominant ideas in the culture.
Because you're a rebel.
About this. No. No, I'm not a rebel. I was walking Friday morning on my way to see Happy Feet 2. I'm walking through the Grove at 8:30 in the morning. Because it started at 8:55 a.m.
Oh, wow. I know where this is going. Go on.
Me and two little old ladies were in the theater.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they knew the song Mama Said Knock You Out. I don't think they were aware that was a song that existed out in the world. But they seemed to be enjoying themselves. But before the movie...
You're discussing Happy Feet 2, which we'll be getting to later in the show.
Before the movie started, I missed the screening while I was down. So I didn't see Friday morning. I was walking through the Grove. And I passed one of those kiosks that has all the ads and stuff on it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And ABC Family, you know how they do their 25 days of Christmas?
Yeah, yeah.
Yep.
They're doing a weekend that's all the Harry Potter movies all the time.
Right, like up to Half-Blood Prince, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what it made me realize is that people associate, you know, this lovely time of the year with, let's all sit down and watch all the Harry Potter movies. And... which means that I've been on you for the past year and a half, even while you were writing the book, Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas that everyone needs to buy right now because it's that time of the year, and we're going to just plug the hell out of this book until December 26th. You put Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix in your Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas
book. I did. Oh, no, actually, no, Goblet of Fire.
Whatever. One of those makes Harry Potter movies.
It makes a difference.
whatever Harry Potter movie has Jarvis Cocker from Pulp.
At the Yule Ball.
Yeah. Right. The Yule Ball. That has the Yule Ball sequence in that most of the action in the film takes place around that, you know,
event.
Time of the year.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, which technically means that you could say it's set at Christmas, even though it honestly has nothing to do with Christmas, and that is why I kept going back and forth with you, arguing about it, how it shouldn't be in the book, and it certainly shouldn't be a cover photo, because people pick up the book and they're like, what Harry Potter movie is a Christmas movie? Like, that's the first thing they see. They see that cover and they're like, which Harry Potter movie is a Christmas movie?
Which makes them investigate further. Right. Exactly.
I would argue, I think at least the first one, when it came out, I can remember thinking of it. Even though I don't watch the Harry Potter movies at Christmas, I can remember thinking of it as a Christmas movie because it's a big deal in the first film, at least, for Harry to, like, get a gift for the first time.
Right.
And, like,
oh,
all that
that's
kind
right,
of stuff.
Right, right, right. Yeah,
so,
yeah,
like,
right.
That one I can definitely associate. Sure. And the other ones, they usually, even though they aren't so explicitly about Christmas,
they're
the
all
the
set.
First one is, they all have that
scene. They're all set over the course of a school year.
Right.
But Goblet of Fire has that Yule Ball.
Right.
And much of what we celebrate as Christmas has its roots in the Yuletide celebration.
All I'm saying is that... apparently, other people might agree with you that this would be a film that a person would want to watch at Christmas time. Therefore, even though it is the least deserving of all the films in your book, of being in your book, it probably deserves to be in your book.
Well, thanks. Yes. Whereas you had no problem with my including Eyes Wide Shut.
That is definitely a Christmas movie.
Okay.
That is absolutely a Christmas movie.
It's fun for the whole family.
That is a movie that uses Christmas to throw everything else into the harshest light possible.
Right.
This is a movie that is surrounded by Christmas things. It begins and ends with Christmas stuff, Christmas shopping and decorations, and then on top of it all, there's like, you know, infidelity and menace and
orgies.
Crazy orgies, and you're like, that ain't Christmassy. And that's the point. Stanley Kubrick did that for a reason.
No, I know.
So Eyes Wide Shut is totally a Christmas movie.
No, that's why I put it in the book. You don't have to convince me.
Cruel, cruel Christmas movie.
Well, I stand by Goblet of Fire because the Yule Ball is, for all intents and purposes, a Christmas celebration.
Great. We don't have to discuss it anymore. I have spoken. Happy Feet 2.
Okay.
Oh, that we're going to start with that one, really? Okay.
Why not? It's a nice segue from when I was just talking about.
Oh, right, okay. Mama Happy said knock V2. You out. Yes, okay. Yeah. All right, fine. Happy Feet 2.
Yeah.
Okay.
Go on.
Go see it. Go see it late. Like if it starts at 9 o'clock, get there like 9:15.
Yes, or just linger in the lobby because you don't want to see
the Sylvester and Tweety cartoon.
Yeah,
yeah. Oh, it was so sad. Yeah, how terrible it was.
It dances on. Is Chuck Jones alive?
I don't know.
I think it dances on the grave of Chuck Jones. Yeah. If Chuck Jones is indeed dead,
your grave is being danced on.
Yeah, and if you aren't, then they're dancing on what's left of your chest. I don't know, but it's horrible. What they've done is they have taken an existing vocal track of Mel Blanc and June Foray, who are like the legendary Warner Brothers cartoon voices, and it's Sylvester and Tweety and Granny, is that the character? You know, doing basically the whole thing is a song called I Taught a Putty Tat. And so they've taken that existing soundtrack and they've created a new 3D
digital
cartoon where like, you can see Sylvester's saliva in relief.
Coming at you.
Yeah. And like you can see all of his fur and you can see Tweety's feathers and it's just
unsettling.
So creepy and wrong and awful and totally just ruins the sort of charm of the original and turns it into this hyper-realistic gross thing.
It was weird that you say that because I felt when I was watching it like the violence in it was the same sort of cartoon violence that you would see in any sort of Looney Tunes cartoon,
but it feels tangible.
Yeah, it felt, and I was like, oh, like this is the stuff I was watching as a kid. Like now I feel awful.
Granny takes a baseball bat to Sylvester's head and just smashes him, and you're like,
yeah, anvils are not as funny.
Used to do that all the time,
right?
In the old cartoons, and you didn't think anything of it, but when it's all like in your face and three dimensional,
the only way it could have been worse.
Like an actual like violence against the
animal.
The only way it could have been worse would be if Andy Serkis had done all the characters in mocap and they had like a realistic looking old lady hitting a realistic looking cat. You know.
Yeah.
Ugh. Anyway, so yeah, skip that one if you can.
Absolutely.
But then the penguins come out and they start doing Rhythm Nation, and I am I'm all for this. I am.
You liked the first one, right?
I don't remember if I liked the first one or not. I remember thinking to myself, before we discuss this on the podcast, I should go and look at my old review of the first Happy Feet and remember if I liked it or not, because I don't remember anything.
I remember
the only
not
thing
liking
I carry
it.
With me to this one is a sadness over the lack
Brittany
of
Brittany Murphy.
Murphy.
Yes, no, absolutely. Pink is no Brittany Murphy, I'm sorry.
Pink is a better singer than Brittany.
Well, yeah, but not as good an actress.
But Brittany Murphy sang a Rolling Stones song to my face in person one day, back in the day.
Yes.
And so, to me,
she is irreplaceable.
She's irreplaceable. And so, I, you know, I associate this now with her.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I started watching, I was like, Brittany Murphy. I liked Brittany Murphy.
I know.
She sang one day to me. Before she was a singing penguin, she sang a song to me.
I remember not liking this movie specifically because that year, Los Angeles Film Critics gave the Best Animated Feature Award to Happy Feet. And I was like,
what was it supposed to get? Persepolis or something.
No. We gave it to
Miyazaki
that.
Miyazaki movie or something?
No. I would have to dig it up and remember what else came out that year. But
just
I
want some Bill.
No, we gave it to that. No, it was probably something, maybe whatever Pixar was that year. I don't know, but I just remember being like, ugh, Happy Feet, really? Like, I didn't like that
was
movie.
Was it against the first Cars or something?
I wouldn't have. In any event, it's not about what it beat. It's just that I didn't think it deserved it.
Yeah, it kind of is, because I don't remember.
Because
is that I didn't care about it.
Even if the movie it beat wasn't very good, I would have been mad if that one had won also then, I guess. But I definitely was mad that Happy Feet won just because I didn't like it. Yeah. You know, it's like someone I know who is on LA Film Critics, who is very on top of the animation world, has begun suggesting that we not present an award at all this year because he thinks that there's been nothing all year.
I disagree entirely.
I do too, because I love Winnie the Pooh, and next week we'll be talking
Winnie the Pooh is fantastic.
And next week we'll be talking about Arthur Christmas.
We're going to wait until next week to talk about it. And Arthur Christmas, the marketing is so
it's
bad.
It's terrible.
They do make it look like it's an
ABC Family like an thing. ABC yeah, family. It looks like another Prep and Landing special. But no.
It's so awesome. I was blown away by how much fun it is.
Next week.
And I'm just prepping people because it's going to open before we
That's
talk
true,
about it.
Yeah.
It opens Wednesday. If you have children, take them to see The Muppets first. And then take them to see Arthur Christmas. Because The Muppets are more important.
Yeah. Hugo will be around. You can get to that one too. But, you know. But, yeah.
Yeah, Hugo, whatever. I haven't seen Hugo yet. So.
Anyway, back to Happy Feet 2.
I'm into these movies now as long as they remain as confusional and in my review I called it an exquisite corpse plot people know what that is.
You might explain it.
When a plot is constructed by different people, like 12 people create a story and they hand it off to each other, and then one more person goes off and writes their own thing and then hands it off to the next person who goes off and writes their own.
I've seen that done in comics where like there'll be a bunch of artists and they'll each do like three frames in a row and
that's what this is, because there is the overarching non sequitur of the fact that it's about singing penguins, but there are so many confusing nonsense things in this movie that, and they just come out of the blue. It's like, okay, now we're going to turn a corner, it's going to be about this and it's going to be about this other thing, and it's going to be about this other thing. And
like Gray said on What the Flick, the screening that we were at, literally kids were loudly asking their parents questions about what was going on.
And I believe that that's good for kids. I believe that kids should be
make them work a little,
to confusion, and that is why you should take your children to see this movie, because it's loud and crazy and weird and confusing and almost like a hallucinogenic drug. I talked about once about how I thought The Lion King was drugs for kids, like a sedative kind of for kids, because they will just sit in front of the TV and watch it over and over and over, like they won't make a sound. It'll just be like, I like it. And then like they learn all the songs. And then, but this is like a freak out for kids.
Especially toward the end, all that crazy krill stuff. It's like out of control, like the krill rave that happens toward the end.
I mean, this is probably the first kids' movie I've ever seen that uses the word existential dilemma.
Yeah.
I wrote that down.
So did Gray. What's the line?
Where is it? Where is it?
Something about dance, right?
Yeah, like why do we dance?
Why do we dance? Why do we dance to sing? It is a momentary relief from the existential. It is momentary relief from the existential terrors of existence. They say this in the movie, and when he said that, I was like, "Oh, I really love this." Like, it's so weird. It's like if the Coca-Cola polar bears
showed up,
I'd have been like, okay, sure, they're supposed to be here.
Doing a production of No Exit.
Yeah.
There are so many just crazy, strange things.
I love
when the baby penguin, say it, tell them what happens.
Okay.
Just
spoil
it, because it's so crazy and weird. And it makes, suddenly it makes the movie like lift off like a rocket ship.
the whole movie is about the baby penguin trying to figure out, you know,
his purpose,
his place in the world, what he can do, because he doesn't
believe in yourself
because he doesn't dance and yada, but then he suddenly busts out a Puccini aria.
And I was like, oh my god.
and at that
which
moment
is then followed by
the elephant seals singing Rawhide.
And then which is followed by
the elephant
under pressure,
by under pressure
everybody
yes
course. But when under pressure, it starts at a time when the elephant seals are trying to break down these ice caps so that the penguins can escape from the thing. So when the song starts, you're thinking, is it under pressure? Or is it Ice Ice Baby? Is it under pressure? Or is it Ice Ice Baby? Like it, and you know the filmmakers knew that. Like they've given you this context where you're like, oh God, what's it gonna be? What's it gonna be? Like, and you're just like, you're just tensing up.
It had to be under pressure.
And then it's under pressure, and you're like, oh, okay. Oh, thank God.
And it's moving.
It is. Yeah.
Like you.
Yeah.
I was really grumpy Friday morning. I had just gone to the Grove, and I had just witnessed, after getting my coffee and donuts from Bob's Coffee and Donuts, where everyone should go get their coffee and donuts in the morning if you were in Los Angeles, because they are warm and they are the best. It's at the farmer's market.
It's where we had our wedding reception.
They're not sponsoring the show, but they should. yeah, it's where we had our wedding reception. I'm walking past, you know, the Banana Republic, and there's this whole line of people outside of the Banana Republic. A big line of people outside the Banana Republic, and I was like, they're not lined up for Banana Republic. But then I saw there was a sign in the window of Banana Republic, now hiring temporary help, and I thought, okay, well, this might be why people are lined up outside Banana Republic. They're so desperate for a job. But then I walked past Barnes & Noble, and the big sign in the Barnes & Noble is two of the Kardashians, I don't remember which two.
Yep.
I thought it was all three.
No, two of them, well, maybe the third one was there, whatever. Cupcake, or whatever her name is.
Cordelia.
Colgate, Cupcake, and Cuckoo. They two of them have apparently fake written a novel?
Yes.
And so
They're the new Brontes, those Kardashians.
People were lined up at 8:30 in the morning for a 7:30 p.m. appearance and signing by the Kardashians. And as I saw that, I thought, I love living in Los Angeles.
Now, we have one of the housewives.
Where this is a thing.
Where even the newly reviled Kim Kardashian can get a line of people of Armenian chicks at Barnes & Noble.
All Armenian chicks, although, you know, a sizable presence.
I'm sure.
But I had that feeling you get sometimes when you live in Los Angeles and you think, oh, gross. Oh, I really love this.
It's like when you drive
to the theater, I was like, okay, everything's gross. Let's watch Happy Feet 2. And I was stunned at how thoroughly bewildered and entertained and happy I was.
I was going back and forth.
I did not dance in
I was going back and forth between like annoyed and enchanted. Like I like when the Cruella would come on, who were voiced by Brad Pitt and Matt Damon. I thought that was really funny and charming and weird. And then
they were super gay.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Gay Cruella.
Yeah. They talked about adopting and everything.
Yeah. They're like, don't leave me. this is suddenly about gay Krill. Like, they're not just good friends. They're a couple.
It's Krillback Mountain. I thought I liked all that stuff. And then the penguins, I was sort of like, whatever. You know, it was kind of generally annoyed by it. But then the kid busts
Don't
out.
Don't you like the little hip-hop baby penguin?
Not so much.
Why not?
And then we went from Puccini to Rawhide to Queen and David Bowie, and it's like, okay, I'm in, you know. And it didn't make me retroactively like the stuff that I wasn't enjoying in the first part of the film.
But the ending is great. Yeah. In this movie, that teach them how to play air guitar.
But there were real life human beings in the first one too.
I don't remember.
You may or may not remember. Yeah. There's a part where Elijah Wood's character gets like captured and winds up in like SeaWorld or something.
Okay. That's right.
And they're like looking at him from the other side of the glass, and suddenly there's real people in the movie, and it's like, what's going on? Yeah, and then he gets back to the Antarctic. And whatever,
the weird thing I felt like, it's part of the stuff that annoyed me with the penguins too, is that there were these moments kind of here and there where it was trying, I felt like it was trying to aim for the whole Finding Nemo, father-son relationship, like, am I a good dad?
Yeah,
like, all that kind of stuff.
Issues.
And I was like, just give me, like, cute British penguins, like, talking in tiny little voices and being adorable. And although I was impressed, especially with the opening one, the mashup that they did, the Rhythm Nation and all the other kind of stuff that they were doing.
What, the Michael Jackson,
Shake Your Body to the Ground.
Yeah. And, like, I was like, why can't Glee do this? Why can't Glee do a mashup this well? Like,
Glee just did Mashup Week and they were all terrible.
Exactly. And they were all awful, and I was like, why
don't watch Glee then.
But Glee.
I don't.
But
I do.
You fast forward through Glee.
I fast forward to get to the part with Brittany, the dumb cheerleader. I fast forward to get to her.
Well,
and I fast forward to get to whatever storyline is happening regarding the bully. What's his name?
Oh, Karofsky.
Which they wrapped him up. I think they kicked him off the show after after wrapping him up.
I hope he'll still
they gave
him pop
2 minutes
again.
Like 2 weeks ago in there, and he was like, "I'm a bear," and they were like, "Okay, great, whatever that is, goodbye." You know, like that was, and so
I suspect we haven't seen the last of him. But here's the thing: I mean, Glee is so crazily cyclical, where like for every show that's like super annoying, they will then bust out one that's actually like
really solid
funny,
and
the character stuff is interesting, and the music works. And so it's, you never know what you're going to get.
That show is actually the human Happy Feet because it doesn't make any sense.
True. They'll turn on a dime, you know.
But no one in that show is as adorable as a bunch of little cartoon penguins.
The baby penguin is crazy cute.
Who are doing the Rhythm Nation choreography from the video.
They
I recommend people go see this weird, weird movie.
If they had fingers, they could do the 3, 2, 1.
Yeah.
I assumed they were going to. No, the movie starts with Rhythm Nation.
Oh, yeah, so no, out the gate.
They start like that, I'm like, okay, sure, I'll keep doing this. I'll be extremely happy.
But
keep doing this.
The
moments it lagged for me were the moments
Robin Williams.
Yeah.
Robin Williams.
I didn't hate him.
Oh.
I did not hate him.
Ugh.
I don't know. I would have rather just rewatched
the
Birdcage instead.
But here's the thing: when Sofia Vergara does Sofia Vergara, she's at least a Latina.
Yeah.
When Robin Williams does Sofia Vergara, he's a white guy being embarrassing.
Yeah.
He sounded kind of funny to me.
Racist.
Oh, I'm racist.
Well, we have an expert witness here, Manny. Your thoughts?
Who does not speak like either one of these people?
Yeah, mind you.
And therefore.
And it was just like Birdcage. Like that's all it reminded me of. That's all it was. Just like that kind of over the top Hispanic,
big,
flamboyant,
yeah.
big. And I was just like, I got it in the first movie. I didn't necessarily, and especially you had that, and then you had the Sven.
The puffin
and all that kind of stuff.
Makes this like the millionth kids movie now where Hank Azaria plays the villain or whatever. It's like...
I didn't think of Sven the Puffin as a villain.
He's as close as they've got to a villain.
Yeah, I mean,
but,
because you can't have like nature
sad,
so much.
Sad, deluded.
Well, but he's introduced as this sort of like charismatic cult leader, so you know that like ultimately he's going to wind up being a phony. You know?
Right.
It turns out to be tries really.
No, he does. He does. Granted,
he
but
wants to be loved
this the movie does not really have villains per se. But you know what I'm saying. He played Gargamel. He played the Pharaoh in Night of the Museum.
I'll
too. It's like
you,
enough with this, Hank Azaria.
I'll tell you who shouldn't have been there because he sounded like he couldn't wait to leave.
Common.
Everything like. It was as though the directors were like, oh, yeah, Common's here. Let's let him say something. And then he would just sort of like, blah, 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 blah. And then it really sounded to me like this was a guy in a studio who was just waiting for his check to be appreciated.
Yeah, I'm sure he's just using it to finance another album.
Well, according to Gray, one thing this movie did that's really unusual for animated films is that they actually put everybody in a room and recorded the voices together, which nobody does.
Yeah.
Because usually the reason that they're able to get big names for animated films is that you come in at your convenience,
like
do all of your lines to like somebody reading with
people,
you.
I've heard of people doing...
and occasionally you're like two people going in at the same time to sort of have a back and forth.
I've heard of people doing this stuff over the phone.
Yeah, oh, mm-hmm. Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Simpsons a lot of time will just they'll put them over the phone. But yeah, so this one they actually put everybody in the room together, you know, Brad Pitt, Sofia Vergara,
everybody.
Elijah Wood, the whole gang.
Maybe for the DVDs, that's why they're doing it. They just want to make it easier and just film everybody all at once.
Yeah.
Right.
So anyway, yeah, I would say I kind of begrudgingly recommend it.
Yeah.
It doesn't all work, but the parts that do work are kind of delightful, so.
It's freaky.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, it's a freaky.
All right, fair enough. What do you want to do next? Descendants or Twilight?
Descendants.
Okay.
Descendants.
Alexander Payne doesn't make enough movies. I mean, I'm I don't want to rush him because the ones he makes are all consistently awesome. So obviously this method works for him. So,
right.
You know, do what you got to do, Alexander Payne.
Right.
But oh man, he is like one of the best American directors working right now. Writer directors, I should say. And you know, this is his fifth feature film, and they've all been great. You know, Citizen Ruth, Election, About Schmidt, Sideways, and now this one, which stars George Clooney, who you might not think of immediately to play sort of Alexander Payne kind of, like, you know, disappointed middle-aged guy.
He's only disappointed in himself.
Right.
He's not disappointed in life.
No, but
he's rich. He looks like George Clooney.
Yes, but and that but for all the good that does him, because he's still got all these other issues going on.
Right.
As the film begins, Clooney's wife is in a coma. She's been in a boating accident during a race. He is trying to juggle having to deal with their two, you know, their young and their teenage daughters, who the wife obviously has been more on top of raising. His family, who are all descendants from the original royal family of Hawaii and some of the first British settlers, are debating who to sell this gorgeous prime beachfront property in Kauai too. It's like the last sort of undeveloped chunk of land in Hawaii. A lot of the natives don't want them.
Ruin it.
Yeah, a lot of the natives don't want them to sell it, but they, you know, some of the cousins need the money. Clooney not so much, because he basically lives off his salary from his law firm, and you know he's tried to sort of not spoil his kids and whatever. And then he brings home his teenage daughter from the school that she's been attending. She's played by Shailene Woodley. Is that her name?
Kid, the boring school.
Yes, yes. And we get the impression that she's had some troubles in the past, and that's sort of one of the reasons why.
It might be boot camp boarding.
Yeah. Anyway, and so, you know, as you find out in the trailer, the teenage daughter and the wife had been arguing before the wife went into the coma, and it's because the teenage daughter knew that the wife was cheating on George Clooney. And so that adds a whole other whirligig.
With Matthew Lillard.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, look, if you're married to George Clooney, you know, you go for the opposite? I don't know. So that sets off a whole sort of other whirligig of him trying to sort of, you know, wrap his mind around that and,
right.
and deal with all the other stuff. And it's, you know, what I love about Payne movies is how he is the master of the sort of embarrassing revelation, not embarrassing revelation, but like the inappropriately blurted out truth.
Right.
Where someone's been carrying something around for a long time,
yeah.
and then it just comes busting out of them at the worst possible moment. And, you know, I the dialogue's really great. This is the first film that he did not co-write with Jim Taylor. He did it with two guys who were from the Groundlings, actually.
Yeah.
Nat Faxon, who you've seen in movies. He's the guy who dumps Cameron Diaz at the beginning of Bad Teacher.
Oh, okay, that one.
That guy. And
right.
and when
we've seen
him on stage. Yeah. And I forget the other writer's name. But anyway, it's just, you know, it's smart and it's unpredictable, but true to life in the way that his movies are. And
it's also nicer than his other movies.
It is less abrasive. The characters are less abrasive.
In his other films, the characters are frequently almost to a human being. Jerks on one level or another, or so flawed and so, like, I don't know what the word is, it's not amoral or immoral, but like doing bad things to themselves or to other people. And so this is,
but the movies are never like misanthropic or condescending.
They're not misanthropic or condescending. But this is the kindest
protagonist,
you know, sweetest, saddest one that
yeah.
I've seen. And I think he started down this path with Parisian Town,
mm-hmm.
which is an anthology movie that had how many directors?
Like 16 or something?
16 directors, yeah. All directing little 5 to 6, 7 minute
yeah,
short
each set in a different arrondissement of Paris.
About Paris, yes.
Yeah.
And it's a pretty good movie. I remember liking it a lot.
It's one of the few anthology films where I didn't dislike any of the
yeah,
of the features.
His is
yeah.
the final piece
and
in
it's
Parisian
so
Town,
great.
And it is also the best
yeah.
thing in Parisian Town. It's so incredibly like moving. Margot Martindale is a postal worker who goes to Paris. She's been saving. And she goes alone because
yeah.
she doesn't have anyone to love, you know. And it's just 6 minutes of her narrating her own experience.
Yeah, like she's obviously taking a French class,
yeah.
and so she's sort of narrating in this very broken French the things that happened to her on this trip. And so you hear her description of things, but then we see how things really went down, what it was all like. And, you know, it's just like she's jet lagged and she doesn't know what she's doing or where to go. But then she winds up having this great sort of transcendent Paris moment. Right. And it is heartbreaking. It makes me cry every time I see it. That year was really pushing
It is on YouTube in its entirety.
Oh, okay.
All you have to do is
we'll post it on the Facebook
14
page.
Arrondissement.
We'll put it on the Linoleum Knife Facebook page. Yeah. But yeah, that year I remember like in LA Film Critics really pushing for her to get Best Supporting Actress because it's just this amazing, amazing performance by her, and it's so sweet and it's so sad and yeah, you know, you're right. It's the transition from like Sideways to this.
This is the bridge from jerks to people you're supposed to like.
Right.
Because you don't just like the people in this movie. You grow to like super like them. Like,
yeah.
There's a kid in the movie who plays one of the daughter's boyfriend.
Yes, Sid.
He starts off as like the surfer lunkhead. And you think, what an irritating child. And by the end of the movie, he becomes heroic.
Yeah.
And I that's probably giving away something, but it doesn't matter because by the end of the film you're like, I love this kid.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And Judy Greer has like three.
Judy Greer is great.
She's so wonderful. Yeah. She has three scenes as Matthew Lillard's wife. And you know, really kind of, you know, she's funny, she's sad, she really sort of bridges this stuff really well. And I you know, she's somebody who's, I distinctly remember the first thing I ever saw her in was that short film, George Lucas in Love. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
It was like Shakespeare in Love. Yeah. That was one of the things where I learned her name. And then, you know, I would see her in stupid movies as like the much more interesting friend to the romantic lead, you know, and then she popped up on Arrested Development and she's in the Hebrew Hammer. Like, you know, she just turns up in all these.
Did you talk to her at the Cornish Christmas party that year?
No, was she there?
Yeah.
Oh, no, I didn't.
Yeah.
I
guess they know her.
Oh, okay. Anyway, I've always thought she was a really talented character actress. And now, having seen her in Descendants, it's like, wow, she is. This is like a Thelma Ritter level performance. Like, this is one of the great sort of Hollywood second banana, you know, things where, okay, I got.
You're that enthusiastic about her.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like,
I mean, I am too, but I mean,
it's like,
not like.
I've got.
You say Thelma Ritter, that's.
Well,
you know,
I know, but I stand behind it.
Okay.
I, you know, it's like, okay, I got these three scenes, bam. You know, I'm going to, like, really make.
Thelma Ritter was a lady.
Yeah. Well, Judy Greer is growing into one.
Broad. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, no, I'm not saying she's exactly like Thelma Ritter. I'm just saying it's the same kind of magic that the Thelma Ritter would do in it with a small role.
Okay.
That's
not
what
that
I'm
she
saying.
Acts like
not that
her,
she, no, 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 no. I'm not
because she was a
yeah, no,
tough
no,
character.
Yeah, no, 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 no.
Okay. That's clarified.
I thought that was obvious, but okay, fine. Have you seen Descendants?
It doesn't open near me till next week. And I've been working like...
Where do you live, man?
I live in the faraway land of Ventura County. So I live in... It doesn't open there until next week. Like our little baby art house theater just got last week...
Birth of a Nation?
No. Not that bad, but we just got Martha Marcy May Marlene.
Oh, okay.
Last week. So they're like a little bit behind. But I've heard nothing but good things about it, and it looks really good. And even my sister, who would never see an Alexander Payne movie, wants to see it because she's like, oh, it's that chick from Secret Life, and she watches that. So that's what the girl...
Oh, Shailene Woodley, okay.
Yeah, she's on that, and she's actually from the area, I guess. From
Ventura
where,
County?
Yeah,
okay.
She's from, like, Simi Valley, I think, from what I understand.
I think it sucks that this is going to be an art house movie for a while. I mean, eventually...
It's a George Clooney
once
movie.
Once the Oscar movies come out, it'll be probably in the bigger theater.
Yeah. Yeah.
Once the Oscar, like, talk starts up more heavily.
Well, but you know what, we always complain about, like, little interesting movies getting dumped into too many houses and dying. So, I mean, I'm glad
right.
that they're platforming.
Yeah, you're right.
You want to build on reviews for this one, because this is, like, this is not Clooney in Ocean's mode, this is Clooney in, you know, Syriana mode. Like, you've got to sort of warm audiences up to the idea of what it is they're going to be getting, you know?
I guess. Now, if you're a longtime hardcore Alexander Payne fan,
mm-hmm.
you might not like this.
I don't think so.
Because it might be too kind and nice. And
But think about it though, because I mean,
because these other movies they have bite.
But yeah, but think
bite.
About but think
they
about
bite you.
think about how Sideways ends though.
Yeah.
You know, I think I don't. It's not like I mean, yeah, his characters can be prickly, but I don't think his movies are necessarily always like doom-filled for their characters or even necessarily... I think ultimately there's a real humanism to him. Like, I think of him like Billy Wilder. Like, he may have characters that are kind of irascible or strange or whatever, but I think ultimately
or
there's...
monstrous.
Or monstrous. But I think there's a real humanism where by the end of it, you know, for the lead characters anyway, you know, the filmmaker wants things to turn out okay for them. So I think if you're already a Payne fan, I think you'll be on board for this one.
I like it a lot. I like Election better, but I like
Election. Well, you know, I probably of all of his probably Sideways is still my favorite, but you know, I like this one a great deal. It's
like
definitely
any movie where Reese Witherspoon is beating the evil.
Well, yeah, but I would say this is certainly a top 10 contender for me. All right. So you know,
the Twilight Saga,
Breaking Dawn, Part 1. Breaking the Dawn, Breaking the Dawn.
Breaking Hymen.
Well, okay, we should start this with a disclaimer.
We've discussed this already. We talked about this already.
I know, but...
We talked about
people
it.
People who are tuning in for the first time.
The director of this film, Bill Condon, has been in this house, and he is. I have served him pumpkin pancakes that I made myself. And
yes.
He said they were good.
So, we should just get that out there to begin with.
And you are friends with his partner, Jack.
Yes.
And, I mean, I am too, but you're like, you guys are bros. I mean, you go to dinner and things and
yes.
Hang out more often than I hang out with both of you. And I think that this is the best of the Twilight movies. And I think it's because of Bill Condon. I think that they are idiotic movies,
yep.
Like, all across the board. And but this one finally gives you a fully sort of palpable expression of how deeply disturbing and full of unease and weirdness and derangement this entire scenario is. And I think, like, these are not horror movies, but there's an element of sort of spiritual and emotional horror for young girls.
Yeah, well, this one almost turns
that
into, like,
never
body
really
horror.
Gets... That never really gets fully expressed because it's all been sublimated under this, you know, this romance, and this, like, will she, won't she, which one, him, which other one, like, well, who will she pick? And,
yeah.
And you know, I don't care who she picks.
Well, but who will she pick?
They're both twins.
It becomes important because who she is directly related to who she picks.
Right.
Because that's all all this character is.
Right, exactly. And so this movie's about, like, the most obsequious, unsure girl who can't, you know, function without, you know,
a
the
man
guy.
In her life, yeah.
Whichever guy it is, she can't function without him. She can barely function anyway.
Nor
and
they
so,
without her.
Yeah, and so...
Oddly.
So I think that's what appeals to everybody who loves it so much. That whole "I can't live without you" kind of element, and you know that whole
or the idea that someone can't live without me.
It's a perfect sort of visual representation of this argument that I used to hear back in the 80s when people would say things that about like Judas Priest music and Ozzy Osbourne music and heavy metal will make kids commit suicide, and the truth is that no. Whitney Houston songs will make you commit suicide. And the reason they will make you commit suicide is because they peddle lies about love. About, you're my everything, I am nothing without you, I will die without you, I can't live without you. And if you break up with someone and you have enough diet of that kind of song in your life, you're going to kill yourself. Ozzy will just be like, they don't love you anymore? Go bite a head off a bat. And so... The reality is that gross things, horrible things, monstrous things, evil things, wicked things don't drive you to suicide. Fake stories about what love is, commit is what make people kill themselves, or go kill the person that doesn't love them and then kill themselves.
Right.
Yeah. And so finally, I think we get a movie that tells you a little more of the actual truth about the reality of these films. You know, she starts off the movie, she's about to get married. Does she look like someone who wants to get married at the beginning of this movie? No. She is tottering on high heels. That's a symbol. and the look on her face,
and what's the
all
first...
the way up until the marriage itself is like,
yeah,
bite my lip.
That's kind of just her face.
What's the first line in the movie? I actually wrote it down, but I don't have it. Something like, childhood is the kingdom where
you never die or something.
Where people never die. And
So yeah, clearly there's a reticence about going blossoming, as it were, into maturity.
So I like that element of it, and I liked, as you just said, the body horror element of it, where finally it's like Cronenberg for tweens, where you get like he bites her in the womb and uses his
vampire
venom, like, venom juice semen or whatever it is that like
coats her inside.
It's like Pepto Bismol.
Coats, soothes, relieves
with vampire goo and like the baby's trying to eat her from the inside and it's gnarly.
She's sipping blood out of a straw
and loving it.
Blood's dripping from her.
I think that Bill Condon made as good a Breaking Dawn Part 1 as anyone could have.
Yeah.
I think that he found the things that he could really run with as a... He's a guy with a horror background. Not only did he do Candyman 2, but like his original scripts were things like... Candyman. his original script... He started out writing... He started out writing films like Strange Behavior and Strange Invaders back in the 80s. So like, and, you know, his big breakthrough was Gods and Monsters, which is the sort of celebration of James Whale, as sort of seen through the Frankenstein films.
And there's a little shout-out to
there is, yeah, movie, which yeah. I definitely like that in this one. So, you know, this is they picked well in sort of getting... Because they talked about they really wanted a prestige director for these last films. Like, they talked to Gus Van Sant, they talked to Sofia Coppola, who would have been an interesting choice.
Yeah.
No one would have left.
Can you imagine?
No one would have. No one would have left the house ever.
I'd have been so happy.
But I think Condon was he's a really good choice. I mean, you know, he gets the horror stuff, and also like gay guys are really good at girl teen things. There's
I think they are.
I mean,
no, they get it wrong.
No, I don't think so. Yeah. I mean, because you know, I like if you look at say, you know. Jim Fall doing
about Glee again now.
Oh well, okay. I was talking about like Jim Fall doing the Lizzie McGuire movie, or Tommy O'Haver doing you know Ella Enchanted and Get Over It.
Okay, that I get, but the sexuality elements of it, no.
Well, in any event, that said, I think what unfortunately Condon is saddled with is these terrible
awful
books
source material.
This cast of people who. While some of them have proven themselves to be interesting in non-Twilight movies, they're hella boring in these movies, and they keep doing the thing they always do. And so it's just like, lots of staring and brooding and nostril flaring and lip biting and all that other stuff. And so it's like, I felt bad for him because I felt like he was sort of, you know, it was like this giant boulder was 2/3 of the way down the hill, and they're like, okay, steer it, you know. This movie is inane, but it would have been much worse had like Chris Weitz come back or somebody else had done it because it would have just been more of the usual Twilight awfulness. So yeah, I will give you that it is the best film of the series so far, but that's not much of a compliment.
Yeah. I was never bored, and there was blood.
I was
tons
extra
of
bored.
Blood. Yeah,
and there was all sorts of creepy. He hit me in a couple of kiss stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I'm super into that.
Stephanie Meyer and her sexual issues are the stuff of doctoral theses to come for the next decades. Because, but between the sort of abusey husband stuff and the sort of abortion stuff and the sort of, it's all so bananas.
Yeah. No,
it's a monster child, not a choice.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's... I mean, the only thing I was happy about, because I will say flat out, I've never liked the Twilight movies. I didn't really get into the movies, and even into Twilight, as it were, until I was teaching. Because I, for all the listeners out there, before I did what I'm doing now, which is retail horror of another kind, I taught high school English. And when I was teaching, that first year was the year that I think that year New Moon came out, so Twilight was still really big, and all the girls were getting into it, and all this kind of stuff.
New Moon, the book or the movie?
The book.
Okay.
And I think it was like right before the first Twilight movie was coming out. And so I was like, okay, like I, you know, and all the, like almost every single girl I had in all of my classes, I taught freshmen and juniors, were reading it. And I was like, okay, I need to read this to at least see what's going on, and it's awful, and it's written terribly, and it's one of those things, it's like a drunk fifth grader wrote it, like, high on Smarties or something, and, like, and I was like, what is this awfulness? And then, like, I didn't read the other ones after that, but I kind of, you know, was aware of what was happening with them and all of that, and I was like, this is an awful, like, role model for girls,
no,
and it's
yeah,
one of those things that I think that, especially with this movie and the stuff that happens in this movie, is, like, you have a whole generation of girls who are seeing this, and to one degree or another, are kind of taking it, like, oh, I should have a boyfriend who doesn't care, and if he hits me a little, then maybe it's okay,
yeah.
And all, like, there was a girl, there was a whole row of, like, two rows of, like, collegiate girls behind me when I, because I didn't get to go to a screening of this. I had to see it, you know.
At Breaking Dawn?
Yeah, but it was, they were all, like, so enraptured. Like, every
no
second. Yeah, and it was. And
life will teach you.
Well,
yeah,
I'm going to repost it on the Linoleum Knife page on Facebook. I did a piece last year for MSNBC basically saying that, you know, in the same way that psychiatrists will talk about the Cinderella complex or the Peter Pan syndrome,
yeah,
that they totally need to, like, bone up on
and
their
Edward Cullen's.
Yeah, because the Jacob conundrum, you know. I mean,
yeah.
Really, these characters are setting up an entire generation of women and maybe even men,
yeah,
to have, like, super messed up views of what relationships,
yeah,
are supposed to be. And, yeah, so
yeah,
it's a horror show.
The only people that came away clean for me were Anna Kendrick, who only has a couple of lines,
yeah,
but
she's always,
but she's funny, and she could, you know, get away with it. And
our friend who's 18.
Yeah.
I did enjoy that.
Yeah, yeah. And
and her wedding toast was very,
yeah,
funny.
Yeah, and
too.
I don't know what his name is, but the guy who plays her father.
Yeah, is it Billy Burke?
That's,
yeah,
I
like him,
because he at
mustache,
least seems
mustache dad.
Mustache,
yeah,
dad,
because he seems
Cop
at least
stash
aware of what he's doing. Like, he's aware of the kind of silliness that he's involved,
yeah,
in.
Yeah, I mean,
he
gets the sort of, like, raised eyebrow, like, lines,
yeah,
about the goings-on.
Yeah.
All the carryings-on and whatnot.
Yeah, and I just, I don't know if the thing, like, with Condon 2 directing it, because my sister has all the movies on Blu-ray, so I subjected myself to them earlier this week. And I agree about it being, like, the best in terms of the way it looks and all of that. Like, I actually thought the whole sequence, a lot of the stuff in the wedding was really pretty.
Oh, yeah.
I think, like, the whole part where, like, everyone sort of fades away when they're,
mm-hmm,
kissing was really,
I
nice.
Like that.
And then, like, the nightmare that she has with, like, the pile of bodies,
mm-hmm,
and, like, the bloody stuff, like, that was cool.
As Matt Atchett, who said, worst wedding cake ever.
But it was, but I'm sure, I'm waiting, I'm giving it a year or 6 months until somebody has that as their wedding cake. Like
the pile of bodies.
Yeah, some crazy person will have a pile of bodies with the little Edward and Bella at the top, and it'll be like, and it, you know, it'll have a raspberry jelly inside.
I will forward that around the internet when it happens.
Well, nothing beats. Remember that woman who had the life size wedding cake that made of herself?
Yes,
that was the best.
That was great.
That's crazy.
And now we have to wait another year. And actually,
is he just Bill Condon?
Condon's doing, yeah, he's doing that too.
Okay, cool.
I was kind of amazed I haven't read the book, but I know sort of, you know, I knew going in what goes down.
There's going to be fighting in the next one.
Well, yeah, because
here
I thought, like, the big climax of the book was, like, the childbirth and the imprinting, and that all happens in part one. So I was like,
yeah,
okay, so we're just moving past all this stuff, bam, 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 and now, yeah, part two is just going to be all like, with the Volturi.
They're going to be fighting with the Volturi, who will lose because they have to lose and because they're just too faggy to win. These guys couldn't do anything. Yeah, this is like, they are the limperestedest group of vampires,
yeah,
I've ever encountered.
The Michael Sheen of the underworld movies could totally,
yeah,
beat the crap out of the Michael Sheen,
yeah,
of the Twilight
movies.
Yeah.
They're like, you know, this is the final, the little bump at the end during the credits.
Yeah.
I was like, oh no. We're just getting started.
It was like that old SNL sketch, remember Tales of Ribaldry?
Right.
Woo!
Yeah. It is that,
Michael Sheen is the queen.
Yeah. You know, when you're worried about getting your cape smudged in the midst of a battle, you're not, yeah.
But at least that means Dakota Fanning will be back, right?
Hopefully.
Right, yeah.
They didn't kill her yet.
I want her to projectile vomit blood on somebody in the last movie. If we're going to get more bloody, which there better be more.
Right.
I was disappointed that the monster baby looked like an actual cute little baby.
Yeah, it was like...
Yeah, it wasn't wrong.
Because I had this... I was as far back as the second one, when Jen Yamato, formerly of Movies.com,
yes,
movie line.
Right.
Jen is a huge Twilight.
Yeah, girl. Unironically.
Yeah.
And was, you know, always trying to explain it to me that how I should like it. And, like, I would always want to sit next to her during the screens of the movie. Because the first one, I totally enjoyed the first one as an audience experience because I was witnessing actual
hysteria
happening in the culture. And I thought that was fun. That was fun.
No, I was with you at that one, yeah.
And then part two and three, I was like, oh, God, kill me. Please, please make this over soon. Because movie two and three can be summed up in 10 seconds. She doesn't know which one she wants. Part one. And she doesn't know which one she wants. Part two.
Until she does.
Until she does, yeah. And so, look, as long as Bill Condon has gotten this next one,
yes,
that means there'll be blood, and it won't bore me out of my mind like the last two have.
That's it. Those are the movies this week. So
it's time to plug a million things.
Well, first off, our DVD pick this week
because ours is a plug.
Yes.
Okay. So next week, the first season of The Adventures of Tintin, the animated series, is coming out.
From Shout Factory.
And I've watched probably the first disc. It's 13 episodes, and I had only, you know, the movie's coming out and all that kind of stuff, and I had only kind of heard of Tintin before it, and I was never raised with Tintin growing up or anything like that, and I think
because you're not European,
because I'm not European, and I was raised, you know, with Tales from La Ranchera and all that kind of stuff. And,
Chupacabra.
Yeah, exactly. And it was always the Chupacabra that was going to get me in the middle of the night. But what's nice about it is that it does
cover... Beware of La Llorona.
Yeah. And it was...
The Aswang.
Yeah, and it covers... It does have The Secret of the Unicorn, which is what this movie is going to be. And it also has... the first couple of episodes are The Crab with the Golden Claws, which when they talked about it at Comic-Con, they said that Spielberg was talking about that was the... They used a chunk of that story to put into this movie because that's when Tintin meets Haddock. And there's the sequence in the trailer where you see the whole... the yellow biplane that, like, ends up crashing in the desert and all that kind of stuff. That's from that story, and it's done, and so it's a good, I think, if you know, if you have kids or if you're gonna see Tintin and you don't know anything about it, it's a good way to get into it. And especially I think it's really good for kids because it's silly without being stupid, which is always good.
And what's cool about the 2D, I mean, and I've seen Tintin, and we'll talk about it when it opens, but I think what's cool about the TV thing that we're seeing is that it's, while it's not as sumptuously done as a movie version that way would have been, it's at least a nice sort of 2D rendering of
Hergé's
really gorgeous line drawing style, you know. And the movie doesn't do that. But,
yeah.
You know, we'll get into that later. But yeah, that's a good pick. And also, if you're prepping for your December of Spielberg, there's a documentary out called Making War Horse about the production of the stage play in London, where the horse is played by a very large and elaborate puppet.
It's coming, I think, this summer, right, to the Amundsen.
Oh, is it? Oh, cool.
I heard something about it that it might be coming to LA because I wanted to see it.
Yeah, the Broadway production won a Tony this year. So anyway, the doc kind of shows you how the stage plays put together. Just, you know, might be a nice pairing with the Tintin.
Is it a Spielberg movie based on the play?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, all right.
Which is in turn, I think, based on like a young adult novel, actually. But obviously the Spielberg movie.
I just see the trailer and I think that my niece is going to go bananas.
Oh, is she at the horse phase?
She's been in the horse phase for like 4 years. I don't think she's ever getting out of the horse phase.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay, so our DVD pick, which is our shameless self-promotion, is Caged Men from Code Red DVD. It comes out this Tuesday, the 22nd.
What year is that movie from? 1970? 1971?
71, I want to say.
It's terrible.
Yeah, it's this rather ridiculous sort of Canadian gaysploitation men behind bars movie.
Yeah. Will turn you...
Like super gay?
That.
Yeah. Anyway, but it's Dave's and my first feature-length DVD commentary.
And I don't remember anything that we said, and therefore I'm hesitant to recommend it because we might actually be finally shown as the idiots that I always fear we are.
I don't remember what we said either,
I'm the idiot.
I'm sure we were compelling.
And I feel like I'm scared we ruined everything. But I'm excited to hear what I said because I don't remember it all. It's going to be new. All new for me.
And it's also the first time this movie's been released on DVD. And it is an interesting sort of curio of that era where, like, the only movies that could really sort of directly address anything remotely gay were things like that and Fortune in Men's Eyes and, you know...
Which is great.
Yeah, you know, yeah. These sort of bananas films.
Go to prison, turn gay.
Done and done. So, also wanted to mention, as we have for the last few weeks... The holiday season is upon us.
That's right.
It is.
And I have written a book called Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas, which is
you need to buy.
It's a film guide for holiday films.
A lot of copies.
And you can...
Give them to all your friends.
You can get it at Amazon.
Hate Christmas. If you hate Christmas, we have some friends who really hate Christmas.
Yes.
Like, who just don't even celebrate.
Yeah.
Like, they boycott the very idea of it. I think those friends should also have this book.
Okay.
I agree.
Just because they should support... You as a human being, and
buy it and give it to someone else if you're a Christmas fuss budget. But anyway, if you would like to order an autographed copy directly from us, drop us an email at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com.
Not directly from us, from you. From the autograph.
Okay, well, yes.
I didn't write the book.
Okay, if you want to order a copy directly from me, and
I just criticize it.
And I will sign it to whomever you like, to you or to whoever you're giving it to. Drop us a line.
All the people that you're giving individual copies to.
Yes, all of them. Drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com and we'll get one out to you.
Or you can just buy it on Amazon unsigned and it's cheaper there.
Yes, that works too. It's all good. And
but if you try to go look for it in a store, even if there is a bookstore near you, I don't think, do they have bookstores anymore near people?
Not a whole lot, unfortunately. Yeah. And I don't think I'm in...
not going to be in a bookstore because they don't put books in bookstores anymore. Yeah. I was in Barnes & Noble Friday morning looking for a specific thing that was...
Not written by the Kardashians.
Not written by the Kardashians. There's a whole lot of not books in Barnes & Noble.
Yeah.
There's a whole lot of everything except books happening in Barnes & Noble.
Yeah, I know. I think I last year was sort of my 1 year to actually get to be in brick and mortar, and this year I've been relegated to the internet, but that's fine. That's how everybody buys books now anyway, so if they buy them. And it's also available on Kindle if you are inclined.
Whatever that is.
Also, also coming up, if you are in the Los Angeles area, on Friday, December 2nd, I will be signing books and selling them at the Aero Theater in Santa Monica. It's a part of the Montana Avenue Holiday Walk. I will be hosting a double feature of two movies that are in the book that are not on DVD. So this will be your one chance to see them this December. The first one is this great film noir called Christmas Holiday from director Robert Siodmak and written by...
Christmas noir.
Yes.
Get that in your head.
Written by Herman Mankiewicz of Citizen Kane fame and Ben's grandfather. based on a short story by Somerset Maugham, and it stars Deanna Durbin, the singing ingenue in her first adult role as a tormented brothel singer whose marriage to a psychotic, gambling, mommy-obsessed murderer went awry, and he has now escaped from prison to come after her. The mommy-obsessed, psychotic, gambling murderer is played by none other than Gene Kelly.
That's right.
It's amazing, this movie. So definitely you want to come out and see that. The second film in the double feature is a comedy called Comfort and Joy from Bill Forsyth, who's the guy who made Local Hero and Gregory's Girl. This was part of in the 80s when he was really on a roll. And it's a funny and bittersweet movie about a depressed radio DJ who winds up brokering a truce between warring families of ice cream truck owners. I highly recommend both films. You should check them out. And
if you live in Los Angeles and you don't come to this, then you're dead to us.
No,
how you like them apples?
Well, you're dead. You're dead to Dave. I will have some understanding because it's tricky to get to Santa Monica on a Friday night. But please come. It'll be a lot of fun. You'll have a great time.
They could make the effort.
It can be done. And coming up on December 6th and throughout the month of December on Turner Classic Movies, I will be featured on a new documentary called A Night at the Movies, Merry Christmas, which is part of their ongoing series of genre-based docs, and I'm one of several people who will be talking about Christmas movies. You can follow us on Twitter at LinoleumCast. We are I can't even say our own name. We're the Linoleum Knife Podcast on Facebook. You can check... Stop it. You can check into us on getglue.com. We're still listed under TV, but I'm going to try and fix that. Stop. Manny checks in.
I do check in.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Yes.
Back me
both,
up on
you're
this.
You're both get-gluers?
Yes.
I am, absolutely. Hey, you know what? I'm so much of a get-gluer, I can now get real stickers.
Oh,
if I really
oh, we've,
to.
We've been getting them.
Yeah. Oh, you've
see,
been getting them.
Yeah, got, see, here's my laptop.
Oh, there
here's
you go.
Here's my Madea sticker. And here's my Mary-Kate Olsen from Beastly sticker.
How beautiful.
Yeah. So I mean, they're good for the sticker.
I took
but
the
useless for
yeah.
I look, it's social media. I took my new batch of stickers to the Outfest office and put them on the we have the, you know, the keys to the men's room and the ladies' room are attached to these
like
blank boards. CDs so that people don't put them in their pocket or whatever. And so for the gals, I put the Rachel Maddow Show cocktail moment sticker, and on the dude one, I put the Fast Five sticker.
There
so.
You go.
So check into us there. I want to thank the Game Night guys for mentioning us on their show recently. That
you
was
said our names.
That
you.
Was that was a treat. We live for that sort of thing. Manny, where can people find you online?
You can follow me on Twitter at False Mirror, FalseMirror. You can follow Very Aware on Twitter at VeryAW, because we didn't want to save up all that precious Twitter real estate. You can follow Veryware on Facebook, and we also have an iPhone app that you can download for free in the
yeah.
iTunes
store. How come we don't have an iPhone app?
So you can get us all
What would
there.
We do with an iPhone?
I was going to say, we'd need
or
to have, we would need a lot more content.
You could make like an RSS app. There are some podcasts that have where like it'll instantly they download it to your phone when the podcasts come out.
What would we do with it?
I don't know. That's something we can talk about later. As
hey, everybody, it's us again. We've got nothing to say.
Anything else? Have I left anything out?
Bye, have yourself a movie little
yes.
Christmas.
You know, check out all of our podcast pals who, frankly, we plug every week. You know who we're going to say. So just listen to an old episode.
When we're done plugging
I'm taking the
of
week
our,
off.
When we're done plugging all of our Christmas things for the next several weeks, we'll start talking about the other podcasts we like again.
I will be.
In the meantime, those other podcasts should be plugging us and
I will be appearing on the Popcorn Mafia soon for their annual Christmas movie
right.
episode. So
right.
More on that as it gets closer.
I will be appearing here at my house, decorating a Christmas tree and making mince pies.
Yes,
yay.
My aunts are doing that as we speak.
Nice. All right, well, listen, we thank you, as always, for listening, folks. Manny, thank you for joining us
thank
today
you
on
for
the show.
Me.
And
thank you for the muffins.
Yes, they were great. And, folks, you do not want to miss next week's episode because six major films are
everything.
Opening on Wednesday, the day before Thanksgiving.
Right.
So we are going to have a lot to talk
One
about
of them
next
is the
week.
Muffins, and it's perfect.
Yep.
So, anyway, join us then, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.